Hello there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'm Dr. Dawn Motieka, your host for an hour of medical debate, dialogue, discussion, health in the news, and a variety of topics. And before we go any further, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It is not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. It's the virtual Dr. Dawn here today, and today I'm the one asking the questions. Our guest is Dr. Bernie Siegel, a surgeon who initially specialized in cancer surgery, but who was drawn into a unique life path as a healer, a teacher, and an author, focusing on turning a cancer diagnosis, the ultimate lemon, into the ultimate lemonade, spiritual growth. I hope you'll enjoy this interview with Dr. Bernie Siegel. I know I enjoyed having it with him. I always love it when people do a new book, because then they do a book tour and they're accessible, and that way I get to interview them again. And today I have the great joy and privilege of bringing you Dr. Bernie Siegel, who is one of my real gurus in medicine. I encountered him very early in my medical training, and I have to say I give him credit for a lot of the humanistic, reject the excess techno-nonsense that has gotten me where I am today, which I think is in a nice moderate space. So I'm just thrilled to be able to bring you a conversation with Dr. Bernie Siegel. Bernie, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Dawn. Can I ask you a question?
You bet.
What's a moderate space? How would you define that?
Well, the way I would define a moderate space is a place where you use technology and pharmaceuticals appropriately, particularly emphasizing acute and life-threatening circumstances, where you support the body nutritionally and energetically, emphasizing getting rid of toxic emotions and also giving oneself a healing space on a regular basis just to stay healthy. And so it's kind of, I'm not a naturopath fully. I don't reject the pharmacopoeia, but I also always am looking for the lowest risk, most nurturing approach to chronic problems.
Good.
So that's what I meant by moderate.
All right. It's just interesting that you picked that word, but I'd say yes to you. A word that has become very important to me is potential. Mm. You know, to helping patients achieve their greatest potential. So it's not about, you know, dying related to statistics or anything else. You know, I just bring that word up to people to say, let's see what your potential is. Let's give it a try. Of course, the sad part is that there are a lot of people who are afraid to try.
Exactly.
You know what I mean? They've grown up with guilt, blame, and shame from parents, teachers, religions, all a whole host of things, even from doctors. And so when you ask them to participate, they become fearful that they'll do it all wrong. And, you know, if they're not immortal, then it's one more thing they failed.
Right. One of the things I really want to share with my audience is the fact that you were really brought up in the system. Attended the right university, graduated with honors from Cornell Medical College, general medicine, pediatric surgery, oncology surgery. This back in the 60s and 70s, which is a time when it was real Dr. Kildare, wear the white coat, you know, the steel and the fluorescent lights were just like the holy energy coming from the god of science.
Right.
And yet within that context, you found that you needed more. You needed to bring more to your practice.
What changed my life, literally, was going to a meeting I thought was for doctors. You know, it was about caring for cancer patients. I saw it advertised. So I went, thinking there'll be hundreds of doctors.
What year was that?
Back in 19, I think it was 77.
Okay.
There were two psychotherapists there and myself. Those are the only physicians. Everybody else were patients. And there were mine. And the literally what redirected my life, because I love people, and it was painful to be a surgeon and not be able to cure everybody. Or even spiritual questions like, why would God make a world like this? You know, things you never talk about at the hospital. And so there I sat next to a young woman with breast cancer who was my patient. And she said, these are her exact words, "You're a nice guy. I feel better when I'm in the office with you, but I can't take you home with me. So I need to know how to live between office visits." And that's why in 1978, we started support groups. I was amazed at how few people responded to my letter. And I'm sending a letter to my patients saying, you want to live a longer, better life, mailed out 100 letters. I said, come to a meeting. And I expected 300 to 500 people. I was really a nervous wreck because I realized you didn't say it's only for the people who got the letter. So they're going to bring their friends and relatives. And less than a dozen women showed up. So I realized I don't know my patients, their will to live. But also what the group taught me was when you help straighten out people's lives, well, maybe just quoting a letter I got, okay? I was told I had 2 months to live. This time I agreed with the doctor. So I bought a dog, put it in a backyard wildlife habitat, laughed more, took some vitamins, and the letter ends with, I didn't die, now I'm so busy, I'm killing myself. Help, where do I go from here? I told her to take a nap. But what I saw was that when people healed their lives, now I call it being born again, and I don't mean that in any religious context, even though religions and myths teach us that. You know, they're trying to tell us the same thing. You run into trouble, take a look at your life and eliminate what's killing you. So that's what I began to see. When people healed their lives, rebirthed themselves, started out on something new. Again, I don't make up these stories. You're a lawyer. You're told you have a few months to live. You always wanted to be a violinist, but your parents wouldn't let you. They wanted to be proud of a lawyer son. So you close your office, pick up your violin, and get a job in an orchestra, and a year later, you're not dead. Or you move to Colorado because it's so beautiful here, I want to spend the last year of my life. I called a year later asking why I wasn't invited to the funeral. Again, the man answered the phone, said it was so beautiful, I forgot to die. So those are the things I began to learn. And again, it might not be, you know, that you go on till you're 80 or 90, but instead of dying in a few months, you may live 5 years. Those were the things that I would say, you want to try. Let's see what your potential is, what we're capable of doing. And one more, excuse me, because I never stop talking, I keep thinking of stories, but it's a line from a poem by John Updike, and it talks about a scab being a beautiful thing. You know, it's a sign of how our body loves us and heals. And he has a line in the poem that says, your body loves you. That hit me years after I put it in one of my books, just at a new depth. I realized, yes, our body loves us, but if we get up not loving our lives and our bodies, what does it do to us? It ends our life faster so we can be at peace. So Monday morning, more heart attacks, strokes, suicides, and illnesses. But if we get up saying, I love my life, then your body literally makes genetic changes and suddenly a disease disappears. I mean, somebody I knew back in the 70s who had extensive, he had an osteogenic sarcoma, metastasized to his lungs. Everybody expected him to die. He's alive and well today. I just heard through an email recently, he had to have lung surgery for another problem. They found calcifications in his lung, and they couldn't understand it. But yeah, I'm sure what it is the original metastases became normal bone, and they're still sitting in his lung, but it's not cancer anymore.
Right, it de-differentiated.
Right.
It turned back on the differentiation.
And that's built into plants, animals, viruses, bacteria. You know, we're capable of surviving antibiotics, vaccines, and weather changes. And I think that ability is in us, though our lives are a lot more complicated.
You mentioned earlier culture, and I have to say, I think that you were primed probably by your mom.
Yes.
To be ready to listen when the information came through. My favorite quote, another one of my great heroes, is Louis Pasteur. A translation of one of his aphorisms, chance favors the prepared mind.
Yes, right. What I've learned is, from my personal experience, I don't have time to go into details, but I was born an ugly duckling. And what I learned from the ugly duckling story is, you see, he could have resented his mother who threw him out of the house and told him he wasn't, you know, a handsome young man, and he embarrassed her. He could spend his life hating his mother. And I see this in people in group therapy, 50, 60 years old, they're still saying, my mother's words are eating away at me. Well, why not abandon the past? Let go of your mother. But the ugly duckling calmed his mind, looked into the still water, and saw his true self reflected back. I'm a swan. And I had a grandmother who helped me realize, you're a swan. Because my folks had a lot of problems dealing with me. I don't mean they didn't love me, but they didn't know what to do with someone who upset people if they saw him. So it had to do with a lot of birth trauma. But anyway, I had a grandmother and who gave me that love. And what I realized is I grew up a multiple personality who was loved as an infant, so I wasn't afraid of the world. See, even being a strange surgeon, you know, being different. I wasn't worried what the other doctors thought about me. Yes, they knew I was capable, so they sort of gave me permission to be a little crazy. But if I had been worried about what other people think, see, if I've been a multiple personality brought up with abuse, and I'm afraid of relationships and what other people think, I never could have accomplished what I did. That's to be different in a setting where other people are observing you. So, you know, I was thinking when you first introduced me into being different, I brought a tape recorder into the operating room in the 1970s. Now, some of the gases are explosive. So I walk in with an electrical appliance and everybody yells, "You're an explosion hazard. You can't do that." Well,
I'm sorry. Can I just interject and say, can we say Bovi? Can we say Bovi cautery? I mean, they were using those in the operating room, weren't they?
Yeah. But I guess those were probably grounded or, you know what I mean, made safe. So you walk in with an appliance, they worry about you. But once I played the music, everybody felt better. And now, again, 20, 30 years later, somebody puts up money to do a study on music and shows, hey, Siegel was right. But everybody felt better. So within 3 or 4 days, nobody told me I was a hazard, and they were all playing music and bringing it in. So again, what I learned was don't give a lecture, tell a story, let people experience it. And if it works, then they ask you to give a lecture about why it works. But I always said nobody was against success. So if what I did worked, it was amazing how the hospital adopted it. Whereas in the beginning, you know, he's crazy or that doesn't make sense.
In your latest book, which is called Faith, Hope, and Healing, and has lessons written by people who are cancer survivors or who have passed through a cancer experience with a spouse or a child, you reflect on each story. And I find that the reflections are very valuable because you point out things and what people's experiences were that are really generalizable. And you talk in your introduction about survival behavior. And I'd love it if you would just talk to us about the survival behaviors that you've observed in, pardon me for saying so, but 40-plus years of patient care.
Yeah.
In that time, you've had the opportunity to make some generalizations about what constitutes survival behavior. Please share that with us.
All right. And the reason I call them reflections, they're just what I mentioned to you about the ugly duckling. That's why I use that word at the end of each story, to stop and let's reflect upon what we can learn from it. But on a simple level, it has to do with spiritual resources, the ability to express emotions, and to seek information and help. I always say that if you don't have the inspiration, the information is useless. And I mean that literally. When you look at self-destructive behavior, it's not because people are stupid, but it's how they've been brought up. So I've also learned as a physician, reparenting people means an enormous amount. In other words, I persist in loving them, even though they may light a cigarette under a no smoking sign in the waiting room. I give them return appointments. And what I've seen is 6 or 12 months down the road, they begin to realize they're worth something. So I'd say survivors have self-worth, self-esteem. Most of them will say, yes, my parents loved me when I was a child. It's a minority of the others who can make that transition. But in terms of specific questions, years ago, this was a questionnaire that was given to AIDS patients. If they answered properly, you knew they would be long-term survivors. And I may add one more little thing from a psychologist named Bruno Klopfer. He was given 24 personality profiles of cancer patients. This was maybe 20 years ago. And he correctly predicted 19 out of 24 times who would have slow growing, who would have rapidly growing cancers. One time he said, I can't be sure. And 4 times he was wrong. So people need to understand, we're not blaming them, but you need to look at what has happened in your life in the year or two before you became ill. And what is your personality like? Are you a survivor? What models do you live by? How did you grow up? Now, specific questions are, do I have a sense of meaning in my work and daily activities? And to me, that's about contributing something worthwhile, like love, to the world. You see, relationships and connections keep us alive. But I try to make it clear to people, as many men will say, I can't work, what's the point of living? I've watched women die after 20 years when their 9 kids have left home, this one woman. Then her cancer came back. It's like, where was it for 20 years? Oh, well, I can't die till they're all married and out of the house. So I want people to live an authentic life, find meaning, and something that they contribute each day when they get up. Expressing anger appropriately. In other words, expressing your emotions. And what's appropriate anger, especially in the hospital, if you're not treated with respect? If someone says, I don't have time to answer your questions, or how's room 422? You're not a room. You're not, you know, a gallbladder or a breast cancer. You're a person, and you want to be treated with respect. So if people don't, it's okay to make noise. You can say, I love you, but I don't like how you're treating me, and let them know who you are. That you ask friends and family for help when you need it, because this is something that always drives me nuts. You know, people email me and say, oh, I just learned to have cancer, and I don't want to upset my family.
Yeah, that's a big one, is people thinking that they're protecting their family, and it's...
But then they're hurting themselves by not getting the help that they need.
I also think they're denying the family, the people who love them, the gift of being able to show that love.
Well, the truth is, if your family can't handle it, they'll let you know. You know what I mean? It's amazing when you walk in a hospital room, there's a card, you know, on the bulletin board says, we love you, but we're going to Europe for 6 months. I mean, to me, that's saying, you know, we can't handle it. We don't want to be in touch. And the ones who can't will step back. See, George Solomon, the psychiatrist who came up with this list, said the most important question in the list was the next one. Am I able to say no to someone who asks for a favor if I can't or don't feel like doing it? Nurses literally have a lot of problems with that because of their nursing personality. But again, you see, you can say to your family, I need a ride to the doctor. I need somebody to make a meal for me. And they can say no. Because I always say, I don't know who's going to die first. So if the family can't handle it, hey, you're teaching them something, that it's okay to say no and not get annoyed with you. Because literally, I see some families who look sicker than the patient because the patient is using their illness to manipulate everybody and get attention. And I point out to the family, you have a right to say no and take care of yourselves. I mean, years ago, I was a very angry doctor because of all the things I couldn't cure and a lot of family problems. And Elizabeth Kubler-Ross at a workshop looked at me and said, Bernie, you have needs too. And boy, that sentence has stayed with me my whole life because I was just so mad at everybody for all the things that were happening. But we need to remember it's okay to say no. Next, if you're asked, you know, to undergo a certain treatment, do you have the ability to say no so that you make the decisions about your treatment? I call life a labor pain, and I say don't let others impose the pain. I mean, I don't have radiation, chemotherapy, and surgery because my family says we don't want you to die. I'd say you all go have it and then tell me if you still agree I should do it. It's my decision, right, and it's my life. I mean, I meet people who hate vegetables and would rather have an operation so they can eat everything. And it's up to the individual. And another one that's very important is that you use your discomfort. And the best way I have of getting the point across is, because a friend of mine was talking to me when I was not having a good day, and she said, Bernie, do you get upset when you're hungry? I said, no, why should I get upset when I'm hungry? I go get something to eat. She said, right, so what do you need to nourish yourself? And that has always stayed with me too. So I say to people, yes, you can get depressed, but instead of getting depressed about being depressed, knowing depression is no good for your immune system, and it's, you know, down, you go into the darkness, you can say, all right, I'm feeling depressed, or I'm fearful, I'm worried. Fine. What do you need to resolve this? How can we redirect things? What help do you want to ask for? How can you nourish yourself and your life? Then the feeling doesn't become a problem. It motivates you. It's, again, like a labor pain that gets you moving. And so the curse can become a blessing because you say, okay, this is what I need to change. This is what I need to do. Fine, get up and do it. And stop sitting, you know, in a dark room, depressed and not willing to change anything. Finding play in your life. My definition of play is what makes you lose track of time. Mm. And what taught me about that was some of my own physical problems, injuring myself and so forth. And while I had a back injury, two things. I could paint portraits, which I do, or operate on someone and have no pain or any awareness of myself. That I realized you're in a trance when you're caring for others or creating. So I could stand for hours. And when the operation or the painting was done, it was like, oh, I gotta lie down. But that really impressed me. It's auto-hypnotic in a sense. So if people can find what makes them lose track of time, their body gets a wonderful live message. And I think that's why people who love their work are never working, if you know what I mean, because they're going to something that they look forward to and their body appreciates it. And last but not least, am I living a role in my life to the detriment of my own needs? And what that means is that you're not, you know, mama or the wage earner or whatever. As I mentioned in the beginning, in finding meaning in your life, that you're not just living a role. You're living an authentic, meaningful life. And that's where I have to keep repeating, connections and relationships are what it's about. In some studies in nursing homes, people live 5 to 7 years longer when they were given a plant they had to take care of. And people given a plant to decorate their rooms didn't live as long as the people who felt, I have to take care of this. We know from so many studies with pets and dogs and how much longer you live if you have a dog in the house. Well, you could have a goldfish in the house as long as it's something you connect to and care for. And that's why women live longer than men with the same cancers because, as I said, can't die till you're all married and out of the house. And the men are just into physical things. If I can't do, what's the point of living? So I know several men who committed suicide when they were told things like, you can't work, play tennis, sail your boat. And I always say, if a doctor said to me, you can't work anymore, I'd put it on the refrigerator so my wife would leave me alone and I would go and enjoy myself.
In this book, you talk about imagery and how language. I want to start with language before we do imagery because, you know, that there's that cancer survivor versus cancer victim. We have a lot of healthcare professionals who listen to this program, and so I like to kind of frame this as good advice when you're taking care of a cancer person is to call them a cancer survivor. And don't tell them we're going to kill your cancer. And why is that, Bernie?
Well, Mother Teresa said it well. And by the way, on my website, there are a lot of articles like Waging a War Against Cancer. And it's Bernie Siegel, SIEGELMD.com. But Mother Teresa said it so beautifully and simply. She was asked to come to an anti-war rally. She refused. As the people were disappointed in leaving, she said, but if you ever have a peace rally, call me. When you wage a war, you focus on your enemy and you empower it. Literally, I had a patient who was a Quaker. He went to an oncologist, said, I'm going to kill your cancer. And Dave said, I don't kill anything. I'm a conscientious objector. I'm a Quaker. And he walked out of the office. And that's the lack of lessons to doctors and communication skills. One of our children, you talk about words, came home from school with a canvas. He wrote the word words on it endlessly, just line after line, words, 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 with no space. And I realized you look at it, words become swords. Because if you look at it, words, swords, swords. And we can kill a cure with words. They are really important. And when you tell people we're going to kill, you lost your battle. No, you're not a loser. We need to say, how can we heal ourselves and our life? How can we find peace? So the body instinctively knows how to heal. I don't give people a page and say, okay, I just operate on you, now do this. The body knows instinctively what to do, but it needs to feel the peace and the love to do it properly and quickly. The other is with words that I've learned. It was fascinating. I don't even know what got me started on it because I wanted to treat their experience. So I'd say, what are you experiencing? What are you going through? And if somebody said carcinoma of the colon, I'd say, I have no idea what you're going through. That's your diagnosis. But when they came up with words like draining, turmoil, confusion, failure, roadblock, pressure, then I'd say, how do those words fit your life? Oh, thank you. See, so again, the curse suddenly becomes a blessing that redirects you into what needs to be done for your life. And you'd be amazed what people come up with when you say, what's the pressure? I mean, it could be a marriage, okay? What's the failure? Oh, my parents committed suicide when I was a child, so I must have been a failure as a child. What's draining you? And boy, they look at you and say, thank you, because they now go home and have an idea of what they need to do to help themselves. And as I said, that as doctors, too, you know, I keep thinking of all these commercials on television, how they tell you what's good, you know, if you have a headache or you're depressed, and then the next 5 minutes tell you, you know, that your body could fall apart and you could die if you take this pill. Too often what doctors do is tell people all the things that'll go wrong so they're not sued and they have to warn you. But they never tell them this is good for you.
That's right.
At one hospital years ago, they were telling people possible complications in the operating room. And they were telling this to people just before surgery. The cardiac arrest rate went way up, so they stopped doing it. If you tell them the night before, okay, you can talk about it, adjust to it, but you don't scare people to death just before they go in the operating room. Those are things that we have to learn and understand. Let me also add this. It is so incredibly powerful. What you believe happens to you. So I know we can inject saline into people and say, this is chemotherapy, your hair will fall out. And guess what?
Their hair falls out.
At least a third of them have their hair fall out. When Rogaine was tested, the placebo, 30% of people had their hair grow. So especially with kids, I learned how powerful my words were. They trusted me, had faith in me. So I had no problem taking a bottle of vitamins and writing anti-nausea, hair growing, whatever the kids didn't like feeling, okay, this will remedy it. And the kids would take a vitamin and feel better. One of the most impressive stories I heard was from another physician, because he hears me talking. He comes up, he says, I got to tell you a story. I said, what is it? He said, we had to fix our radiation therapy machine. A month later, we're doing a routine inspection of the machine. We discover after they repaired it, they did not put back in the radioactive material. So we hadn't treated anybody for a month. I said to him, do you understand what you are telling me? I said, you'd have to be an idiot to not realize you weren't treating anybody. I said, you obviously had people whose tumors shrank, who developed red skin, other side effects of treatment because they thought they were being treated. And he looked at me, he said, my God, you're right. And I told him he ought to write an article about it, which I don't think he ever did. I mean, that's how powerful one's belief is. And so I would say to kids in the emergency room, we're going up to the operating room. When you get into the room, you'll fall asleep. I'm thinking they'll be, you know, they're going to be anesthetized. And I would have kids fall asleep as we wheeled them in.
Mm-hmm.
And it got to be humorous because some of the kids flipped over on their stomach. And when I turned them back to operate, they'd say, why are you doing that? I said, I have to operate. Get your appendix out. You told me I was going to sleep, and I sleep on my stomach. Boom. And I realized how powerful my words are and how literally they took them. And I recommend to all physicians that they become familiar with the work of Milton Erickson, psychiatrist who grew up with polio and understood the power of doctors' words in being destructive or constructive in healing him. Just one brief little anecdote. I was told that he would write in the chart and then say to the patient, excuse me, I just thought of something. I have to leave the office for a minute. And he'd walk out and you say to patients, what would you do? Well, I'd look in the chart. Yeah. He would write doing well and walk out of the room. And think of how good that made the patient feel. When they saw, oh, doing well, yeah.
Yes, I think that is a really important thing to emphasize because we are always hypnotizing ourselves and hypnotizing our patients.
Yeah.
And our words are extremely powerful and we need to be in control of them.
Yeah, I think we're in a trance 95% of the time.
You use a lot of drawings and also guided imagery.
Absolutely.
So, you appear to take kind of a Jungian perspective that the drawings themselves have a gate to unconscious knowledge.
Absolutely.
Tell us some stories about where that's come through to you.
See, first of all, I have never met, so you're a lot more intelligent than most healthcare practitioners. Why do they say that? Even use the, you know, Jung's name. Because I will ask medical students, did you ever hear while in medical school that Carl Jung interpreted a dream and correctly diagnosed a brain tumor? No. When I speak at graduations, I like to say, well, then you're not getting your diploma. There's so many things you don't know. And yes, they laugh because they know I'm kidding. But
the French taught me that, by the way. I spent a year outside of the United States, so that's where I learned it.
But that's what's so sad here, you know, that we don't talk about these things. So when a patient says, oh, I had a dream, the doctor looks at this. I mean, a dream. What's that going to mean? But it's incredible the information that can come from our body through the unconscious, through dreams and symbols. And literally, one Jungian therapist that I visited with in London, Susan Bach, and she wrote a book called Life Paints Its Own Span, because children with leukemia that she worked with, they don't have a problem with drawings. See, they're not worrying, am I an artist? Will this be okay? Because I had a woman with cancer bring me a drawing and says, have my 10-year-old son Bobby do this because I'm not good at drawing. That's written at the bottom. you're trying to get over cancer and you're worried about your grade in art. And so she wrote this book, and I went to see her, and she said Jung was fascinated by the somatic aspects. I said, because he knew anatomy. So he saw things in drawings that you might not see as a psychologist because you're not familiar with the anatomy. And that's why, as a surgeon, I found it incredible what people drew, and sometimes whether to operate or not operate, told me what their diagnosis was, showed their anatomy in the drawing. Now, do they know what they're drawing? No. It could be a tree or a stream. But when I look at it, it's like, wow. Maybe people, even with just words, I can't hold up a picture of people who are listening, but a young man drew a tree. If you think of just bare branches, when I looked at it, I knew that was his brain because of the shape of the tree and all the little lines that would be exactly what the brain looks like as you look at it in a profile. And it told me his cancer had come back because he had put some black lines in it. So I was able to prepare him for what he then learned weeks later from a CAT scan. And he was prepared, made up treatment decisions and things of that sort. But the thing that impressed me and what got me started in it, again, I didn't have any belief in imagery. The first time I did it was for Dr. Carl Simonton. He said, we're going to do guided imagery. And I was there to learn, again, ways of helping cancer patients. And I thought, this is nuts. So I sat there looking up at him while he was doing it. And then he looked at me and I thought, oh, he knows I'm not doing it. So I closed my eyes so he wouldn't know I wasn't doing it. But as soon as I closed my eyes, being an artist, all these visions appeared. And they were incredible and totally informative about my life. And then the next experience was, as I mentioned, meeting Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. And she said, Bernie, why don't you draw a picture for me? So I drew a picture for her. One part of the picture was a mountain. And she said, Bernie, what are you covering up? I said, what are you talking about? She said, you put snow on the mountain. I said, yeah, it's a mountain with snow. She said, Bernie, the page is white. You took a white crayon and you added a layer on top of it. What are you covering up? And boy, I thought, wow, it was all my feelings. And then she said, why is 12 important? I said, I've been doing this work for 12 months. And we went on and on. And when she was done, I thought, I drew this little outdoor scene, you know, just sketch something, and it's all about my life. So I went back to the hospital with a box of crayons because every color has meaning. Okay? Like yellow is energy, okay? Purple is spiritual. So yes, you know when people are ready to die, you see a purple kite going up in the sky. And I said to this woman, you're ready to go, but your husband's hanging on to the kite. He was flying the kite. So we brought him in, and he said, you're right. My wife takes care of everything. She's a nurse. If she dies, I'm dead. I don't know how to do a damn thing. And she said, I won't die. I'll train you. And literally, she spent 6 months, at which point he said, honey, I cut the string. And she had no trouble dying surrounded by her family. Or with children who draw purple kites and balloons with the names in them going up in the sky, or a purple butterfly, I will show it to the parents and say, you know, your child is ready. And maybe you need to just take them home and love them instead of all this, you know, treatment. Or you can go to something as simple, just going into schools and say, draw your home and family, and it's a disaster. 80% of the pictures, this is not a family. But you see, again, it's not me criticizing the parents. It's, look what your child drew. And a lot of parents say, thank you. Especially a child with cancer says, I don't get enough time for my family, and drew a sofa. Everybody's on the sofa except her, and there's an empty seat. She's sitting all alone on a chair. And her parents thanked me, because they went home and changed the home situation to give this child their affection and their time before she died. Can I say one more thing?
Of course.
Because I'm just thinking of the benefit. In other words, why do this? I'll say to people, yes, draw, you know, any problem you have. Where should I work? Where should I live? What school should I go to? You can do those things, or home and family. The other is draw yourself, your disease, your treatment, and your immune system, eliminating the illness. Now, how do I help that? If you drew the operating room as hell, I mean, nobody's taking care of me, I'm in a black box, you can say, all right, don't have surgery. Or you can say, how can we reprogram you? See, and that's where the imagery comes in. See yourself going to the hospital, having surgery, waking up, feeling well, doing beautifully, eating a big meal, going home quickly. And a week later, when you say, draw yourself in the operating room, it's a totally changed picture because you and your body have experienced, say, 50 operations that are totally successful before you have to go get the actual one. So people can reprogram themselves. people also begin to realize why they're having side effects. You know, when they say, well, I wanted to have chemotherapy. Why am I having all the trouble? Look at your drawing. You know, it's a black syringe. You're not even letting it in your body. And when they're looking at immune function, they'll draw one white cell and 100 cancer cells. And you say, hey, we've got to change the situation here and put your body to work. So it helps people to create the right images that can then heal their body. And I let them choose. In other words, I don't say, oh, this is a good image, that's a good... Some kids, even though we're not using the word kill, one little boy says, yeah, I have these fighter pilots flying around in my head, boom, shooting the brain tumor. So there are little boys who love that kind of thing, and they don't see it as violent or a problem. Somebody else would. Where one woman said, yeah, I had all these German shepherds eating my tumor, and nothing was happening. And then she said, I suddenly got the image, the tumor's a block of ice, and God's light is melting it. And boom, that's when it literally began to melt away.
Share with us some of your favorite images, additional ones that patients have come up with over the years. Imagery for programming the immune system. There's huge connections neurologically between our brains and our immune cells. All of the immune cells have the receptors for the neurotransmitters. Our brain talks directly to our spleen and to our lymph nodes in the intestines, and it's literally directly wired. And so we don't know the programming language at a scientific level, but we know it at a heart level. And we're trying to encourage people here to speak at a heart level to their immune system. And I think understanding, but through example, you mentioned, for example, the melting ice cube and the fighter pilots.
No, I was just thinking, somebody today, somebody I know, she's a teacher at a local public school, and I've talked to her class. And believe me, that you know, when we say, are you as smart as a fifth grader, that's no joke. When I do workshops with kids in third, fourth, and fifth grade, they are much smarter than adults. When I say workshop, I do the same thing with them as I would do with the cancer patients, and they got the right answers. But her husband has bladder cancer, and they have two cats at home. And she was telling me how the cats seem to sense his problem. When he has treatment, they go and lie down next to him. If he goes to the bathroom, they sit outside the door. And I said, okay, why can't he have the cats lick the lining of his bladder? Because it's getting inflamed from treatment that's being injected. Her email back was, oh, that's a wonderful image. So if he sees his cats licking away the disease, I have lots of animals in the house and two dogs, and if I ever have a problem, yeah, an infection, let's say, I have no problem with them patrolling my body and licking or eating up the offending organisms because they're my dogs. I don't feel that as vicious. They're there to protect me. So again, it's letting somebody find something personal. If you were a plumber, maybe you want to turn off the blood to your tumor. Just turn all the valves down and don't send blood there. And we know that these things work because not just from cancer patients, but from the various monks and meditating skills that people have. Incredible what they can do to change heart rate, blood flow. Matter of fact, in the operating room, I would tell people to do this because they were under anesthesia in a trance, but hear me. So I would say what I want your heart to do. A man had a cardiac arrhythmia while I'm operating. You know, and the anesthesiologist got to get a kick out of me. They would challenge me before they'd use drugs. They'd say, okay, Siegel, fix it. And I said to the man, you're on a swing, up and back, nice, steady rhythm, up and back. And his heart went back to normal. Again, it's coming up with some image that's comfortable for the person. What I found was if I tell you what would work for me, it may be uncomfortable for you. So again, it's working at what is comfortable for me and what's right. And why do I ask them to put it on paper so I can be constructively critical? Because one woman said, oh, I have millions of white cells and only 100 tumors. But when she drew her picture, there are far more tumors than there are white cells. So she's trying to please Dr. Siegel. But when she does the drawing, she showed herself in the corner of the page. The disease is somewhere else on the page, and the immune system is somewhere else, and the treatment is somewhere else. So she is giving up her power. You know, I tell people, you should accept your problem, your disease. It doesn't mean you accept what they tell you is going to happen to you, but you accept it. So you now have power over it. If it's in your body, you have something to say about its environment and what you can do to help yourself get over it and cure it.
I do want to learn more about using art and using these drawings for my practice. And I don't see a large oncology community, but I do see a lot of pain patients.
Mm.
Could you suggest to me as a provider where I could go to learn more about using art?
Well, there are two books that I recommend. One, as I mentioned, Life Paints Its Own Span by Susan Bach. And the other was by Greg Firth, F-U-R-T-H, The Secret World of Drawings. Now, Greg is a psychologist, so there isn't so much physical illness in it. But it, again, gets into various symbols. Because literally, on the page, there are past, present, and future. See, I can tell the future from looking at someone's drawing by what part of the page they put a certain symbol. Like if you said, I don't know where to move to or where to live, and you drew a certain, let's say, a city in a certain part of the page, I'd say that's where you're headed. Because again, as Jung said, the future is unconsciously prepared long in advance. So you're showing where you're headed in the drawing. Each color has meaning. See, those things I could put on a piece of paper and mail to you. You know, say, like the upper quadrant means this and the lower means that. And red means, let's say, an emotional color. Could be rage, could be pain, could be love. Black can be grief and despair. But again, yellow is energy. So if somebody drew that chemotherapy as yellow, I'd say, yeah, go get it. It's good for you. Even though they may be afraid of it, they're intuitively knowing it's right for them. Sitting with the person, you can interpret what's happening. Because I have to add this, that I got such a kick out of one day. A boy came in, the whole picture was black. I said, what's going on in your life? He said, I have two older brothers. That's the only crayon I get. So, you see, you have to know the person. So when people mail me drawings, yeah, I spend a lot more time explaining possibilities because they're not sitting next to me. But let me give you an image that people can see. Let's say you drew yourself with no hands. All right, what are you saying? You can't get a grip on things. You can't reach out. So we know from studies that if you drew yourself that way, in the future, you're more likely to have emotional problems in your life. Even your size on the page tells me something about your self-esteem. Boy came to my office, said, Dr. Siegel, operate on me. The kids are teasing me in the locker room in the gym. I want you to fix my body. I said, draw yourself in the operating room. He literally is a little black insect on the operating table. I said to his parents, he needs your love. I mean, I'll operate, but he needs your love if he's going to feel good about himself. And another boy I went to, I said, draw yourself. And then I looked, I said, hey, you don't have legs. What's going on? You feeling stuck? He said, turn the page over. And he finished the picture on the other side of the page. Now, here's a kid who thinks enough of himself that he doesn't even fit on one page. And the other is like an ant, a black ant on the operating table. And that tells you a lot about the person. So there are so many things that appear in the drawing that can be so helpful.
Well, you certainly have reframed things a little bit for me there in terms of how I might be using this in the future, so thank you.
Yeah. Somebody comes in and says, here's my family picture. If nobody has ears, you're not listening to each other. If nobody has a nose, how can you breathe life? You're not inspiring. You know, they look and go, oh. And again, why do I love the drawings? Because it's not me criticizing or telling them what's wrong. They drew the picture. You know, some will say, oh, I'm not an artist, that's why I, you know, left my head off. Okay, you know, I'm not going to argue with them, but I know that they'll walk out the door thinking about what I said.
Yeah, why did I not put my head on? Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yeah. Or men will only draw a head. I mean, they'll fill the whole page, and you say, look, you're only in your head, your mind. What about your feelings, your body? Male engineers in the office. I said, draw a picture. He wrote a full page of instructions about what to draw. He didn't draw anything. He wrote the instructions. And I said to him, look at this. Look at your response. I asked you for a draw. And about 20 years later, I have a slide of that, and I show it to people. I said, who do you think does this? And they all say, you know, of course, a male engineer. But a man came out of the audience and said, that's my father's handwriting. That's what he did years ago. And you had a profound effect on him because he went home and really changed his life. And could you make a copy of that so I can hang it on the wall at home? So, yeah, I sent him a copy that he could print out and put up at home. But you see, it changed his father because of how he responded to my instructions.
As a doctor, I'll often encounter a person, some with cancer, others with other chronic illnesses,
that I feel are clearly related to the fact that they are a people pleaser, that they aren't nurturing their own soul, essentially. And I find that it's very hard to get past the, oh, I don't want to be selfish, or I can't be selfish. And I'm just curious if you have any advice for me as a healer about ways that you can present to people that it isn't selfish to nurture yourself. Short of waiting till they get cancer, which of course then they're, you know, they're really in a sink or swim crisis, and that does help. But
I'd say three things. One, you keep loving them,
okay,
and always give them return appointments. Don't give up on them, which everybody else has done. The opposite of love is indifference. Worse is rejection, and even worse is abuse. So if you're not indifferent and you don't reject them, I've seen patients 6 and 12 months later begin to take care of themselves. The other is, I literally do this because of what a suicidal young lady said to me. She came up to me one day because I was caring for her and loving her. I didn't like what she was doing, but I loved her. And she came to me one day. She said, "You're my CD." I said, "What are you talking about? I'm a CD." She said, "You're my chosen dad." And since that day, I have adopted psychologically enormous numbers of children of all ages. I just say, "I'll be your chosen dad. I will love you." And boy, what a difference it makes to them. The other two things were, ask them to bring in their baby pictures. Because if you hold up a baby in front of a high school, everybody goes, "Oh." Then you hold up a high school student, everybody bursts out laughing. And I say, "What are you laughing about? This is you a few years ago." Now, I've met people who've been so abused by their family that they literally never had a baby picture taken of them. But I still get across to them, you're a divine child. That, and you have to honor that divine child. How do I make it real? Is to say, okay, you get to heaven. Because I tell everybody I'm on the board of directors of heaven as an outside consultant. And I say, there's an admission line. So you get to the head of the line. They say, "You're next. How do you want to be introduced to God? What would you say?" And if people say, "I'm a doctor," come back when you know who you are. "I'm a mother," come back when you know who you are. "It's me," come back when you know who you are. What am I trying to get across to them? That you are part of the divine. You come from the same thing, made of the same thing. I often say, it's like you don't introduce your right arm to your body. They're part of the same thing. And so when you can say to God, "Your child is here," or "It's you," God says, "Come on in." And literally, the best answer I heard from the high school student, which I know that kid was loved, because I asked, "How would you introduce yourself to God?" And he raised his hand. I said, "What is it?" He said, "Tell God his replacement is here." And that's a kid you don't have to worry about. He's a multiple personality, but he's having a lot of fun with the world because he grew up with love. And people need to learn that they're divine. But the only way they're going to learn it is by somebody truly loving them and giving them that kind of feeling. You know, again, why do we call our children? But when they have children, they become grand. And when they have it, they become great and grand. Because we are more unconditionally loving when we become grand parents or great grand parents. That's why when I go back to my childhood, when I said to my mother, "Why am I not a drug addict or an alcoholic?" I was literally wrapped in kerchiefs and put in a covered carriage behind the house so I wouldn't upset anybody. I said, "Then why am I not a drug addict or an alcoholic if I wasn't touched?" And that's when she said, "Oh, my mother took you." And she poured oil on my body and, quote, pushed everything back where it belonged several times a day. And I realized I was probably one of the most loved kids on the planet. I'm being massaged 4 or 5 times a day by somebody who loves me. My comment to people is, touch one another. And it can be with words, it can be physically a hug, but touch the other person and you'll make a difference in their life.
Earlier on, you mentioned that now, by taking that quiet approach of just showing success, you're now being invited to give lectures. And elsewhere, I've read that courses are beginning to be taught in medical school. How has medical education changed? Has it changed enough? Is it changing in the right directions?
Oh, I'm still very disappointed. It's still decades behind where I would have it. But what makes me happy is that some schools are introducing different courses that relate to patients and their experience. the words of a poem from a lady helped me. It ended with, "I see myself through my husband's eyes, the eyes of a native who overlooks things that only a tourist would notice." And she was talking about the scars on her body. Mm-hmm. But you see those words, native and tourist. Doctors, for the most part, are tourists. When you or your loved one develops an illness, then you become a native. And then Bernie Siegel isn't crazy. And a whole host of things suddenly open up. And most doctors end up writing their own books saying, "Oh, look what I learned mm-hmm. when I got sick." You know, one that was turned into the movie The Doctor was called A Taste of My Own Medicine when the book was written. But doctors need to be trained to care for people. That's what it's about. And when insurance companies and pharmaceutical companies are telling you, hurry up, write a prescription, don't waste time talking to people. But studies show that when a patient walks out of the room and says, "The doctor listened to me," they're more likely to respond to treatment and take that treatment. And I got one drug ad canceled a few years ago. It's for an antidepressant. It was in the New England Journal of Medicine from Sandoz Pharmaceutical Company. And it said, "I'm depressed, unable to cope. I went to see my physician. I said, 'You've got to help me.' He prescribed an antidepressant." I said, "Wait a minute. The doctor doesn't even say, 'Why are you depressed? What's going on in your life?' He hands a prescription." I said, "If my family were killed in an accident, if I lost my job, you don't even ask me. You just give me a piece of paper and say goodbye." And they canceled the ad. One study showed that the more pharmaceutical ads that are in a medical journal, the fewer articles the journal has, you might say, about integrative medicine, you know, and the ability of the person to heal without taking a pill. And that's the sad part. We need to truly teach patients what I call survival behavior. Well, think of the word spontaneous remission. What does that accomplish? You have a patient who has a spontaneous remission. You say, "Oh, well, you lucky, goodbye." No, you should say, "Sit down. Tell me how you managed. What's your story?" Mm-hmm. So I can tell other people. Because in Solzhenitsyn's book, Cancer Ward, now he had cancer. See, he's a native. The men are sitting around the ward. One of them says, "Oh, I discovered this book in the medical library. It says here there are cases of self-induced healing, not recovery through treatment." And it was as though self-induced healing fluttered out of the great open book like a rainbow-colored butterfly for everyone to see, and they all held up their foreheads and cheeks for its healing touch as it flew past. Only the gloomy Padiev, with a hopeless and obstinate expression on his face, croaked out, "I suppose for that you need to have a clear conscience." And when I read that, I thought, wow, he knows the whole story. Self-induced healing, see? Not a miracle or spontaneous, self-induced. And why the rainbow-colored butterfly? Because the colors, as I mentioned, talk about your life. The rainbow says they're all in order. And the butterfly is a symbol of transformation. So you now have your life in order. And boom, look what happens.
Well, Dr. Siegel, Dr. Bernie Siegel, again, I can't tell you how much I admire you and the humanism that you bring to medicine.
Well, let me interrupt that statement, because one of the most important things is, and I share this with people all the time, what you see in others is within you. I have realized, because of the work I'm doing, I get along a lot better with people now. And it's because I'm less critical and less judgmental. I'm more likely to love them, even if they don't treat me nicely. I'm more likely to say, "I love you."
It does.
And that drives them crazy besides. But I would say, when you see something good in me, it has to be in you or you wouldn't see it in me. So what I look for, literally, in people is for them to come up to me and say, "Oh, your book was inspiring. That lecture was inspiring." I say, "No, inspiration is in you. I'm just bringing it out." And those are the people that I love to coach, because they show up for practice and they put the effort in. And that's what I think all doctors should see themselves as coaches, as teachers. So, yes, you can criticize people, but it's feedback. It's how to make them a better patient, how to help them survive. Just as if you were coach of a baseball team, the team doesn't say, "Oh, he told me I'm, you know, I don't know how to hold the bat, or I didn't catch the ball properly." You don't say, "I'm not coming back tomorrow." You say, "Thanks, coach. I'll do it better tomorrow." So to quote the Sufi poet Rumi, criticism polishes your mirror. I'd say, look for it. And how do you know if you're a good doctor? You're criticized by patients, nurses, and family. because they know you're listening, you don't make excuses, you apologize, and you improve.
Bernie, thank you for being ahead of me on the path and giving me courage.
Bless you.
You've been listening to Dr. Bernie Siegel. He is the author of numerous books about medicine and healing, mostly about healing. Among them, Love, Medicine, and Miracles, Peace, Love, and Healing, How to Live Between Office Visits, Prescriptions for Living, and 365 Prescriptions for the Soul. Also a children's book, Smudge Bunny, which I definitely want to look up. You can find more about Dr. Bernie Siegel at BernieSiegel, SIEGELMD.com. And I encourage you to go there and learn, as I have. This is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.